Hey everyone, welcome to this episode of the Optimism Show. Today is our special guest, we have Tani, who is a product developer, product designer, and the bootstrap founder of Intelligent, which is a platform on Farcaster to actually track your social metrics and make better decisions with your social growth. With Tani, we're going to cover a lot of aspects when it comes to product development and product design, but the three main topics that we're really discussing in this episode are: how can blockchain startups design user experiences that even non-crypto users will love? Is your product design truly balancing beauty and functionality? And finally, we're going to discuss, should you bootstrap or raise funds for your blockchain startup? Let's get started. Tani, amazing to have you here today, and I would be happy if you could give the listener some background about yourself and what you're doing.
Thank you so much, Chris, and I'm so happy to be here participating in the first season of the show. Quick TLDR about me. I have been a product developer since last 10 years, more than that, in fact, 13 years counting now. I've mainly been building consumer products for myself. I led a conceptualization agency, a studio technically, where we help brands from the smallest scale to the biggest of the startups, biggest of the organization, create digital solutions. And that was primarily in Web2. And I've been doing that for a long time. Eventually, until I understood and read about blockchain as a field in 2016, I started getting super interested in that. Fast forward to 2019-20, up until then, I had not contributed anything to the field. I was just like a casual observer of the field. I didn't think that I had enough resources to be able to do anything in this field. At that point of time, when the gas prices were almost $200 per single transaction, because Bitcoin was not extendable in any kind of way. When it happened, we finally saw the NFT summer come along. And that is when I created a few products. They went viral. A couple of startups started inquiring whether I would like to join them as a product manager, designer. I started helping a few NFT exchanges build products, but eventually realized that the field really needs some really good, well-polished products out there for them to really expand and increase adoption. Me and my co-founder, Shiv, who I met during 2021, we started a fintech company, a Web 2.5 company called Palladium, which allowed crypto natives to very easily off-ramp and on-ramp crypto from their MetaMask, Rainbow, all their non-custodial wallets directly to their bank accounts. That's how we started it. We did well. Unfortunately, SBF and all the SVB and all those banking collapses happened, because of which we had to pivot a few times, build different products, and now we're running an off-ramp in US technically. So that's all how it has been. But I, on a personal level, of creation, been interested in creating those small experiments with crypto where you are able to do anything permissionlessly. So I've been building those products lately, and very recently joined Farcaster actively, where I was contributing in terms of creating a product that allowed you to have a better understanding of your profile in terms of who you are engaging with. And that is how Intelligent was born. And I've tried to explain Intelligent to a lot of people in a lot of different ways, because when it started as a project, it started as something as just an engagement. I would say it started as a wallet extractor from your engagement. So all you had to do was you had to drop a pass, and everyone who has interacted with that pass, everyone who has commented on it, liked, recasted, or anything of such, you are able to extract the usernames and the wallets which are connected to them directly. And you could then just airdrop them things. And this tool was used by a lot of creators on Farcaster for initially incentivizing their following to do that. And from there, Intelligent progressed a bit into analytics, giving you deeper insights into who you're interacting with, who are your top followers, the impact followers that you could, that are following you, that are also unfollowing you, and because everything is open in terms of blockchain. So this is where Intelligent has been working and operating. Very recently, I have started to consolidate a vision for it, of it being a view of your identity. So the thesis is that as we have the social graph decentralized already, we'll see a lot more experiences being built on top of that. Right now, in the pre-Web3 world, the social media that existed with the notion where the person or the company that took the onus of consolidating your social graph also took the onus of servicing it. But we are seeing this entire shift happening where we have companies like Merkle who contain your social graph into one place through smart contracts, but they do not take any guarantees or warranties of servicing it. What I mean by that is you can use the same social graph and service it in your own way with the same set of people, same set of relationships. As this service layer opens up to everyone, assume we'll have a lot more different data types of relationship exist between the same identities. I want people to use intelligence to track all kinds of different data types into their one place. It could be that you have certain engagement on something like Dracula happening, which is like an ecosystem on Fata. So you have Moxie, which is another ecosystem, and you have fan tokens in them. So there's another relationship there between you and the same profile in countless different ways. But it gets very cumbersome to track them across one platform. What immediately help you do that? And none of the platforms over there will ever be composable enough to help you do each other. It's just intelligence will become that aggregating layer where you will be able to track everything in one place. It's like a god view of your identity. And that's what we will have done.
That's quite fascinating, especially like with ecosystems like Farcaster that practically allow you to own your audience truly, regardless of what happens. Like something like the intelligent really gives you the insights to truly do things, not necessarily just monetize or just know your audience, but actually give you the freedom to do things with your audience and be as creative as you want.
Absolutely. And I think one of my fundamental theses when I started experimenting in Web3 has been the composability nature of it. That you are able to do everything permissionlessly. Even the products that got wild when I first created them were created permissionlessly for the NFT collection that I was building. I did not ask them to pay. I just created them and it went wild. I think that same principle is applicable to a lot of things in crypto. You can create Uniswap hooks and you can create pools, you can create a different lending pool, you can create entire product software around the companies that we have in crypto.
Yeah, exactly. And one thing that I see you're quite passionate about is really the user experience, like really doing this permissionless and as smooth as possible. What do you think are some really key things about user experience that blockchain companies, especially blockchain entrepreneurs, need to keep in mind in order to acquire more users and eventually to really get their consumer app out there?
I think we as an industry are going through a phase where we have been so long into it that we have forgotten that some of the terms that sound very basic to us are not even comprehensible for people outside crypto. So things like wallet, connect wallet, gas fees, I still have people around me, majority of the people, I think even in your life, there are people around who do not understand the basic concept of how these things work. I tell people that we are still in a phase where most of the people are still getting on the internet. And when they get to that mental model, you have to do everything that you can to unwrap that model and install a new model. So thankfully, we are moving into an era where there's a chance that people will interact with it much more earlier than they would interact with the typical internet. There's a chance that we'll have new mental models forming across the consumer space earlier. But I think one of the best things that any company over right now are looking for increased mass adoption is to think about the particular consumer without the lens of crypto. They have to think about the person. They have to think about what that person wants, what that person, the way they think about any certain product. Today we are talking on this platform and we are by the power, in that sense. But we don't care about the technology that goes into building this current video platform that we are talking on. We don't care about the protocols that it's using. We don't care about the hostings that there are. We just care about clicking buttons. So that's what a typical consumer cares about. They don't care about your crypto. They don't care about your wallet. There's this iconic line that I keep on telling everyone is that people who use internet today, they don't care about internet also. They care about talking to their friends. They care about conveying the message and getting the information. They don't care about the internet. So what makes you think they'll care about crypto? They won't. They will not care. So you have to remove the crypto out of that. Get back to the basics of how any kind of business works, what you can offer them, what you cannot offer them. Of course, it does not work for companies which are really operating on the B2B side of crypto, where the end goal is also someone who is operating in crypto. This advice is more for someone who is looking forward to creating viral experiments now that we can because of the gas prices. They need to remove the lingo of crypto completely out of the product. Of course, you are allowed to use terms like on-chain and stuff, which are the new terms, but make it as simple as possible for the end users. Don't make it for crypto natives, make it for just like a normal human being.
Well, that's an excellent point because there's so many companies nowadays that even like we've been in crypto, you probably have faced such a situation, but I have certainly faced a situation where I've been in crypto for years and I still find some companies that I have a pretty hard time understanding what exactly is it that they're doing.
Exactly. And I see that every day. I honestly, every single day, the announcements that are happening with respect to the fundraising and everything, it gets a little difficult to comprehend at the first go what they're doing actually. So definitely, I think we do need a lot more copywriters in crypto. That's for sure. We do need a lot more content writers who can explain things to a layman who does not understand technology. Because forget technology, forget crypto natives. When there are people who do not interface well with their own phones, you have to explain them to them. So
we really need people who will simplify things. Be the bridge between the builders and the end user.
Thankfully, but we are finally seeing those experiments come along where for a long time, crypto has been treated as something which has a problem. And when now we are finally solving the UI problem, we are reaching another problem, that is the incentive problem. Because you have solved the UI, now what? Now what? I mean, why would they use it? And crypto cannot be the answer. It cannot be that when long crypto use it. No, they don't care. No one cares about it.
And curious, like, what do you find are the most efficient ways nowadays to, for example, drive growth to a consumer crypto project?
The way I'm seeing the current landscape, so most of the projects right now, unfortunately, are still targeted towards crypto natives. And it's really, it's not their mistake. It's just that those are the people who are, when equipped with the wallet, are funded with the wallet, and that's their target market. I'm seeing more and more experiments come along the Coinbase wallet site, where they're integrating, even Trivi, for example, where they're integrating fund, on-ramp fund directly into the wallets, where the end user has the ease of quickly going into the experiment. So I think if they really want to do that, I feel they'll have to make it as seamless as Web2. They don't have to talk about fund. Polymarket is a great example, for example. Polymarket has been doing well. Although even their flow right now is geared towards the complex flow of connecting your wallet, on-ramping funds, using either the wallet or a card. So I think we will see some innovation happening on that level, where the step from connecting your wallet to funding your wallet to interacting with the piece of software, that gets abstracted into one. It could be the product-sponsored actions to start with, where the products are sponsoring the first. Let's say you are completing the first loop for the users completely, and then let them choose whether they want to complete the second loop or not by themselves. So I think that's something we'll be seeing. That's what VR also did. I think VR as a field also, because the entry barrier was so high in terms of the cost of owning a device, they started doing the demos all across the world, all across the pop-up. And that's where people started getting the first taste of the technology. And they started getting, we're still far away from that, but that's what crypto has to do as well, just to make it so seamless that they are not able to tell whether it's run on crypto.
Exactly. Like as you mentioned previously, the end consumer doesn't necessarily care the technology. Like, they don't care how the internet works. They want to connect with their friends. Same with blockchain. Like, doesn't matter to the end consumer, especially if it's like a B2C, like actual not a business consumer. It doesn't matter to them if you use blockchain or not. It's the end result. Are you giving me what you're promising? And what
exactly.
are you promising in the first place?
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, it's like, imagine if Skype's landing page was not about connecting and doing the video call with other people. It was more about the protocol that helps you transmit video from point A to it. It doesn't work. It, no one cares about that. Talk to your family and friends on a video call is the answer. It's something that they have to convey. I think this is what's missing in majority of the projects right now. I've been trying to help a few and trying to experiment on these lines to see how it's possible, because it's genuinely difficult right now. The market that exists and the company and the people that they have to cater to in order to survive versus creating an entire mass of new customers for them.
Makes perfect sense. And I would assume like that is directly also connected, like the entire communication aspect of these things is directly connected to how you design the product in the first place. And I would love to hear your thoughts on product design, as I know you're quite passionate about that and you're an expert in product design. What are some things that you believe are very important in product design that every company, or at least the majority of companies, should consider when building their products, and how does that directly interfere with the psychology of the consumer?
I wouldn't call myself an expert. I think I'm more or less self-trained and self-experienced in this field, still learning, and there's a long way to learn. But I would say, from my experience, the way I try to build my products is that I try to keep everything very simple. I follow this approach where, if possible, I'll put only one call to action in the entire screen if it's possible. And I try to do that with every context, every screen, every action, every component, is to have just a single call to action. An average consumer does not want to take that load. Today, we are sitting at a juncture where an average consumer is not even watching 20, 30 minutes of YouTube videos, but they are preferring to scroll on Reels, TikToks, and YouTube Shorts. You know, they're spending more time. I talk to a couple of my YouTube friends, and they tell me that Reels have taken over the entire traffic. They are not getting those many views on there. So by this point, what I mean by that is the attention span has really gone down. So the attention span has really drastically dropped. And what does that do is that the person will not spend a lot of time trying to figure out which button to click on your landing page or on your product. They won't do that. What they'll do is they'll want straight away action. So I think this psychology of making sure that the entire path, even though it looks like a free will, but it's subconsciously a guided path for a consumer, will change the way people interact with their product. Of course, we'll give them optionality, but the entire product should be built in a way where it's guiding your consumer right from point A to the point. That's, I think, is something that a lot of companies should cater to. Most of this comes from being able to think fundamentally of what your product is solving, what's the most important KPI, what for you is considered a success in terms of the user journey. I think if you have that nailed down and you know that, okay, doing the swap means success for me, doing conversion means success for me, or probably notification, any kind of those functions means, when you have that noted down, very easy to push the consumer in that direction, ever so slightly, ever so nudge them towards that. That's what I think. And my product philosophy has always been about creating a minimalist product. I don't, they do look good, but I didn't add an element for the sake of it. I usually add elements which are driven by utility at their base. And of course, that process needs to be beautiful.
Yeah, when it's absolutely necessary. If it's not absolutely necessary, then what is the point of adding something?
Exactly. And because beauty can only take you so far. It needs to be, it gives you the first shot. Honestly, the beauty of a product gives you the first shot. So I always tell people that, yes, making a beautiful product is a good way to solve the cold start problem of your adoption. But then it will not make your users stick. People get bored even with the beautiful products if it doesn't solve what they want to see. So I think that's very important, that you need to have functions or features which are driven by utility, then by beauty, but not to discount beauty as a part of it.
And it's having like, I really like how you structure it down, but like having that utility like first and beauty second. Also, a lot of products, for example, let's say they have a good utility, but they still somehow struggle to retain their clients.
Correct. And I think that's where I mentioned that even though when you focus completely on utility, you cannot discount beauty. So beauty has to be there, but it does not have to be in the driving seat of the product. It needs to be as a co-pilot of being there. It's very important. If you don't have a co-pilot, you miss out on the way you communicate with your end goal, your end users. You miss out on the direction that you're taking and all kinds of things that a co-pilot does in a typical journey. So I think beauty needs to be there. It needs to be there in the way you communicate with people about your product. It needs to be there in the way the product makes people feel about it when they first look at it, you know. And so I think it definitely is a requirement. But for the product that focused completely on beauty, that's where it gets a bit difficult. Because then you're working on the polarizing angle. Either you have companies which are completely focused on beauty, and they don't care about that. They don't advocate for kind of like product. It's not a beautifully branded product, but I wouldn't say it's a beautiful UI in that sense. So I think recently, for example, Family Wallet is a very beautiful product, and it's well done by the entire Bids team and everyone. But I do see that people are not actually using it a lot more than they should have used, and it could be because of marketing or something. But well, I mean, just citing as an example of why overemphasizing the beauty also does not increase your
It's all about having like finding that good balance that it's useful, but it's not overly kind of like, let's say, put it overly colorful in every way imaginable. That does not, because there's also like, you can also, just as you can add features on utility, unnecessary features, you can also add some, let's call them features on the beauty aspect of things, which are still some distracting the user from what the product actually is about.
I'm guilty of it myself, and I've fallen into the trap where I have been distracted by making something look beautiful than the amount that it has to be, and I have to consciously stop myself from doing that. Okay, don't do that. Don't, that border radius is absolutely perfect. It doesn't have to sparkle, you know. So it's difficult balance to maintain, honestly.
It's definitely a difficult balance to maintain. Especially when, because sometimes the beauty side of things is like, or the
exactly
like that.
Exactly. So like, oh, that's so beautiful. I need to keep that. So it's not exactly that, but I, so oftentimes what I happen is that, for example, I design a very beautiful feature and I'm like, okay, this is gorgeous, the animation, the way it's coming, the subtle ease in animation and everything. And then when I show it to the people and their entire focus is on the way it works, and like, okay, that's where I made the mistake. I shouldn't have done that. But having said that, I think it's important to work on design or the beauty until it's invisible. Once it's invisible, stop working on it. It's done. It's solved its purpose. Design's entire purpose is to get the utility done while being invisible. So the moment it's invisible, it's time to stop and move on to something else.
You cannot make it more invisible. If it's
I cannot make it more. Exactly. I think that's what I try to focus now.
And curious, like, you're a bootstrap founder, right?
For Palladium, we did a seed round, a small seed round, but that's about it. We have not raised any type
I just want to cover, so for Intelligent, it's completely bootstrap project.
It's
amazing. So you have experience from both side of the two founders, really, entrepreneurs and founders in like that are working with blockchain or looking into different ecosystems and are either looking at funds or looking to bootstrap, because there's this huge disparity in this huge debate, like, okay, when should I get funding? Should I get funding or should I just build a product myself and like take it very gradually? Like, what are some pros and cons that you have noticed along your way that, for example, you noticed with the funding round and now that you have with bootstrapping?
We can answer this question two ways, actually. So one is, do I need the funds to do that? You know, the thing is, this answer comes from any typical business operation. So the way any business works is you find a problem, you validate that problem, you create a solution, you validate that solution, and you sell. And that's the entire cycle of business. And this same applies to the product that you're creating in web. You're doing anything in the world, this applies to the same. So So in this entire cycle, if you feel that to validate a problem, or first, if you don't identify the problem, you're not getting the funds. If you validate the problem and you are able to create a solution, that is where most of the people for the first time need funds, that they have identified the problem, they have validated the problem, they have manually tried to solve it and it yields results. But now to create a solution is when they most likely need funds. Now, people, founders who are not technically resourced, I would say, usually need it much more than the people who are actually good at the technology in-house. You can create the first type of prototype and product in-house and create the first thing. I think so. That is where I see if you are ever looking to move from bootstrap version of your company to a funded company, you need to have make sure that you have this circle company. You need to know what you're going to do with the money first. I think that only then it makes sense. Otherwise, it does not make sense. It's very, of course, I'm talking in a context of a very specific journey. There are research-oriented companies who require funds irrespective of what they're doing. There are companies which are not operating in a direct end goal of that, but they still have an end goal in terms of who their buyers are. So until unless you don't have the buyers figured out, you don't have, for example, for Intelligent, I did have a few approaches that come towards me in terms of raising funds. But for them, I'm in constant touch with them and working with them to find out the all variables of this equation before I raise funds. But in terms of pros and cons, if I talk about it, definitely if you have raised funds, you get to spend more time and energy on things like making it more consumer friendly in terms of adoption through design and stuff. You get to marinate the product much more so that it's more flavorful when it comes out. But at the same time, it makes you complacent in terms of building a product, and you are always building to validate it, not only with the sellers, not only with the buyers, but also with a third party of speculation driven individuals who are looking to do something in the industry, but you know, it's not always in the right direction. Just because people invest in the companies they are then expected to run after them, make them do things which are not always beneficial for the company. And I think founder loses that touch of flexibility the moment they raise funds. So this flexibility is very important, especially in fields like crypto and when they are early stage companies. But thankfully, crypto investors are good. They understand this this dilemma of being flexible comparatively to any other field, because there's everything new. Every 3 months, there's new technology that's coming, and you are upgrading your stacks. You are working on a more economical blockchain or doing things which are really fundamentally different from what you raise your initial funds on.
Yeah, absolutely. And like it really, as you said, like it boils down to taking it to the simple understanding, like, do you really need the funds at this point? Yeah. And you said, like, you are actually giving up some form of say the moment that you take funds, because you might have to do some things which make perfect sense for investor, but that might not be exactly aligned with the vision in the first place.
Correct, exactly. And it also takes some amount of money to even complete the circle. Sometimes it does that. For example, if you have a certain equation missing from the entire business buy and sell plan, and you need some money to probably create that validation in the first place, that is when you do need the money. But then, of course, that also has to be pre-identified, I feel. Everything has to be identified before you take on even a single dollar.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, like, I really love the fact how you covered, like, product design and really making the beauty aspect invisible, and then you're done with it. So,
exactly.
I gotta go back to that topic, and I'd love to hear more about like how you're putting that into practice into all your companies, like with Intelligent and also previous companies and even future projects that you might work on. Well, do you have like a specific process that really founders can think through, or specific things that they really need to look at in order to achieve this balance this ideal balance that will allow a good user, like an excellent user experience, a very seamless user experience, and to balance out the utility and the beauty of a project so the project can actually grow.
I think, yes. So I think the typical or usual process of building a software products right now is that people first identify how it works. There's a mental model or a mental picture of the flow that they want to achieve in any kind of software right now. They tell it to their designers build it in Figma, and they build 0 to 100 in Figma. They can get pixel perfect, which is then handed off to designer who uses it as a checklist to finish off and then just step it around. The problem with this is that there are countless of thoughts which are happening when you're designing on a Figma, on an empty canvas. And a lot of those designs, if you're just designing for, you're thinking of that product just in the beauty sense of it. If you're a founder or if you're a product manager, you're only thinking of the product in a utility sense of it. And as an engineer, you're only thinking in terms of how I can code it. They're not thinking in terms of the product, they're thinking in terms of implementing. So I have been fortunate enough to be someone who when draws on Figma has all these characters in him talking continuously about all the three processes. So when I'm designing on Figma, first of all, I never design pixel perfect on Figma. I draw 0 to 80 on Figma, where I get like a rough outline and our overall beauty aesthetics nailed down in Figma. But then I go to code and I keep enough room in my entire design phase that if I have to change something and if I have to trade off beauty for utility or utility for beauty, I should be able to do that in code. Because even when I'm coding, I'm not thinking of how I can implement this version of the product. I am thinking how I can implement the best version of this product, and it's just like a reference for me. So I think one way to do that is, and I've seen and I've worked in teams which have done this better, is to really have a cohesive engineer, product manager, and designer work together on the Figma file. I know it sounds very contradictory and it sounds very controversial, to be honest, because this entire group, so by designers to letting product managers and engineers some of their Figma. But I really feel that the more cohesive your smallest individual combination of engineer, designer, and manager would be, the better the end goal. You'll be able to cut down on things much more faster, and you'll be able to achieve that end result in a much more beautiful way, very fast. You have all these people work and put their minds together, engineer putting their minds together in the terms of the implementation and the feasibility of the implementation of this product, designer putting their minds in the beauty segment of it, and a manager putting their mind in terms of the utility.
Yeah, that's actually the real balance that needs to be achieved, which is even going back to the beginning when we started this conversation, which could be causing one of the biggest disparities in the space, that on one side you have something that could be extremely useful, but no one really knows what it really is. It's actually quite difficult to use. And on the other side, you have the other extreme. So maybe it's time in the ecosystem, especially like with the help of Farcaster, and like we have the Optimism ecosystem, the Superchain, and everything, like to start uniting those things. And maybe that is one of the main things that will start bringing consumers to crypto. And it won't necessarily be as a push, like come join our products, but more like they don't even know if they're blockchain or not.
Blockchain, correct, exactly. And this goes deep into every category of it. It goes deep into the marketing and the marketing heads, where they need to remove that lingo, as we talked about, honestly. I think coming back to my previous point, and that is the reason we are seeing a lot of design engineers come out as a consequence of this requirement, where they need to have the brains of an engineer as well as a designer to make a well-balanced product. And for small teams, it's not an issue where you have limited people working together on a product and they try to solve. But for bigger teams, I always suggest founders and everyone to make your designers code and make your designers think like a product manager, like make them do the sales marketing, make your sales guys do the design, make your engineers do the design, cross-contaminate them. so that they achieve that balance internally.
Which makes perfect sense, actually. Like, then probably everyone will be more peaceful with the other person.
Yes, but separate of their shoes, yes. That's true.
Honey, thank you for these insights. Is there anything else that you believe, especially founders of blockchain companies, should hear that is quite important for them to hear?
Stop thinking about crypto as much as you do. First, this advice is only for the consumer founders. Start thinking about people who do not have crypto. Start from there. Don't start from that this person has wallet already funded with XYZ crypto. Don't start there. Start with someone who has not created the wallet yet. Start your journey from there. See how you can support right from that point of time. They use the technology which help you do that. If there are not, create those technologies, create those flows right from the place where someone does not have a wallet. Start from there. I think that's what I would want everyone to understand and, work towards.
Beautiful. Start from where actually the start is, not just from mental
health. Not just midpoint. Exactly. And if you do that, it will be very, very easy, not only for everyone else in the industry, but you will bring the adoption for your software. I think that's where. And changing these terms, thinking of them as just app and stuff.
Amazing. Tani, thank you for being a guest.
Thank you so much, Chris. It's been so amazing talking to you.
Thank you for tuning in with us on this episode of The Optimism Show. Don't forget to subscribe and actually share this episode with your friends and connections that might benefit from the insights shared in this episode. And if you'd like to get the notes as well as the short summary of the entire learnings from this episode and the key points discussed with our guest, go to optimism.show/insights. And until next time, stay optimistic.